Great to see a turnout tonight. I don't usually compete with fireworks shows, so it's nice to see you all here. The title is What You See Here, Why Was the First 4th of July Important? Now, as often happens when you think of a title months beforehand, you think the lecture really isn't quite as grand as the title sounds, which is the case tonight too. But I will be taking one specific strand of importance of the 4th of July and running with it, which is, I think, something that's been really interesting to me and very important. We relate the 4th of July to freedom, to democracy, to American freedom and American democracy, and the glories thereof, sometimes with some understanding, often with a lot of naivete, but it's a great moment, a great time to celebrate who we are as a nation, going back to our beginning. I'll be looking tonight at a more basic idea that is really underneath and makes possible all the ideas of freedom that we often think about, really that make freedom and democracy possible of the sort that America has produced. So the foundation stones underneath them, and particularly looking at the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. So I'll start with a short-ish historical running start, because I can't bear to talk about the 4th of July without actually talking about what happened leading up to it. But then look at and reflect on the second paragraph of what was signed on the first 4th of July. Particularly where it comes from and where it's going. In other words, how did it arise? I'm thinking particularly here of the idea of all people are created equal. And this is, I hope to show, absolutely fundamental to the notion of democracy that Jefferson was talking about, that people were fighting for, and that they hammered out together. Where does this come from? How did it arise? And then that's looking backwards, but then looking forwards, what is its fate now? What is happening to it now? So, background, leading up to the...
Here, I'll give you an outline.
leading up to the 4th of July, 1776. Starting in England, 17th century was a rough century in English history. A lot of big events. They executed a king. They had a full-bore civil war. They had what they called the Glorious Revolution, ending in 1688, where the monarchy was reestablished after being totally in question in the whole middle of the century. But monarchy reestablished with a different political idea, more based on power rooted in the consent of the governed. That's going to be a big sort of phrase or a collection of ideas in this lecture, and very important in thinking about the revolution. The people governed, expressing their thought through electing members of parliament and dealing with parliament. So the parliament was between the people and the monarch. But by the Glorious Revolution, the parliament had a much stronger grasp on overall authority than it had before, under the Tudors particularly. In the meantime, the relationship with the North American colonies had gone really pretty well through the 17th century into the 18th century. England, according to its mercantilist purposes, had done quite well by it. A lot of the colonists here, and you can tell this by looking at the size of the houses in all sorts of the towns along the east coast here, had done pretty darn well for themselves also, especially in the port towns, Boston, Salem, and so forth, going all the way down the coast. They've done really rather well for themselves. Some of those houses are date back to early to middle 18th century. But then in the middle of the century, there's what we call the French and Indian War. It's called in Europe usually the 7 Years' War between, as usual, France and England, who are usually the combatants on most occasions throughout, on and off through most of the centuries before. But unlike earlier combats, this war took place mainly on North American turf. As England and France were trying to hammer out who is going to own what and colonize what at this time. I had an ancestor who fought in it and who, because they didn't have money to pay him, was given a bunch of land in northern Vermont as a payment for his services in fighting in the army. So the colonists themselves did a lot of the fighting, were able to organize and be military units together, as well as military units sent from England. And there was a sense of elation because among the colonists, because they had beaten the French and they'd stood and had amazing victories, and also the potential to develop land, now having beaten the French, went all the way to the Mississippi River. So there was a sense of it being not in question. There was a huge potential for open development and expansion to the West. But the one problem is that England went deeply in debt for running this war. It's fighting a war across the whole ocean ended up being enormously expensive for them. George III became king in 1760. This was just before the end of the war. The 7 Years' War, the French and Indian War, ended in 1763. So he took the crown just before that war ended. He was not the crazy old eccentric nutcase that he's often pictured, as he was as an old man, because he really lost it. He was afflicted with some physiological and then mental disease. He was very sharp, very able. He was 22 years old when he took the crown in 1760. And he decided that with this enormous debt, he can't possibly pay it off from within the English population. We're going to have to draw on the resources of the colonists themselves, because after all, the war was fought on their turf for their sake, you know, to make their lives safer and to go forward. So he thought it was perfectly fair to hit them pretty hard with the burden of this debt. This meant that he directed a series, this is through the 1760s, he directed a series of taxes, tariffs, duties, and trade restrictions onto the colonists in North America. The colonists, in the meantime, had been, from the early 17th century, getting used to self-government. You know, they had governors of each colony that were appointed from the crown, but other than the big decisions, they were making them themselves. They were electing people for public office, important positions. They were debating and carrying on local government in a very self-rule-oriented way in local matters. So when these taxes and tariffs and economic restrictions started to roll in, they got very, very nervous. This was something quite new and quite different, something they had never experienced before, to have taxes laid on them from above, restrictions laid on their economic activity. And they protested. They protested long and hard, and because they felt, and in some senses rightly so, that because when a country far away with no communication system imposes taxes on another colony at a great distance, they don't do it in a very coordinated way, sometimes in a very thoughtful way, sometimes in a catastrophic way for the people on the ground here on this side. So they protested that these taxes are ruinous. I think you listen to the rhetoric of, and Boston was the center of this, the people who felt their pockets pinched hardest, I think, were Boston merchants and traders and seafaring lot. They saw the end coming, and And no one would listen to them. Under George II, there'd been a group of people people who talked to him and advised him that the colonists had connection with. So they had a sense all the way through that they had some connection with the crown. George III comes along, he fires them all and sets up his own group of advisors and so forth, and they had no connection with him. In Boston in 1761, a very bright lawyer called James Otis argued a court case arguing that the colonists were being deprived of the rights of ordinary Englishmen who lived in England and who had representation in Parliament because they lived in England and got to elect, or at least the well-heeled of them got to elect members to Parliament. We were not represented in Parliament, so we have no way to register our views and just grievances. Yet we are being taxed without our consent and without mercy and without understanding. Otis claimed that Parliament had passed a law that was against its own constitution. It had to do with the writs of assistance. He lost the court case, but set loose a train of thought in the other colonists that never stopped. It began to be a great force in the sense that their mismanagement wasn't just mismanagement, but it's violating their own constitution, and we are being denied here as colonists the rights of ordinary English people. And in no time, it began to escalate to speak in terms of enslavement and tyranny, okay? And tyranny that would stop at nothing. This got pretty, as the 60s went on, this got pretty hot. And all sorts of things happened. There was the Boston Massacre, which I don't want to get into, very publicized by Paul Revere, making a print of this, which is kind of exaggerating what probably happened, although no one knows quite. 1773, you have the Boston Tea Party, where there'd been, which you probably got done the Freedom Trail or whatever, or at least many of you gotten this in school, but there'd been a monopoly forced on the import of tea. Now, there was only one part of the East India Company was allowed to import tea. No one else could bring tea to the colonies, and much of the rest of the world as far as they could determine or enforce. But they saw, because they saw how this is working, they, meaning the folks in Boston who were very much on edge by all this, they saw that the people scraping off the top were a corrupt group of British politicians here and in London just scooping off the profits from this just tremendous restriction on the trade of tea. Colonists tried peacefully to turn back ships laden with tea and not let them unload in Boston. This did not work very well. Then in November 1773, the ship called the Dartmouth docked in Boston Harbor. There was a lot of discussion about this that didn't get much of anywhere. And then, you know the story, on December 13th, a group of men disguised as Native Americans took over the ship and dumped 342 barrels of tea into Boston Harbor. That's a lot of tea. In protest. This was not an act of, a sort of a backyard act of vandalism. Historians would say there were 8,000 observers. This is before public media, it's before television. Somehow, there was a consciousness raising that happened. 8,000 folks were there to cheer. And so, yeah, I mention that because that gives you a little bit of a sense of the consciousness of Boston.
The total population of Boston was what at that time?
I'm not sure. It was more than that, but it was, I think, in the 20s. I'm guessing. I ran across it, but I'm not sure.
I think it's close. It was a significant fraction of the number of people in town.
And it was so that they were getting a lot of people from outside of Boston too, who were up to, you know, because not every citizen of Boston would necessarily want to get up and witness this thing. But they knew it was coming, and they were arrived. They were there to see it. The English were not amused. They shut down the whole harbor. They shut down the whole port, which is as much as shutting down all economic activity in Boston. So it's not a small bit of discipline. It's going to stay shut until the colonists repay the amount of tea that's been lost, for which everyone thought they're going to have to wait a while to get that. More troops were brought into Boston, and a particular grievance also was in quartering them in private houses. In other words, they would tell people to just get out of your house, we're going to take over your house, and they'd fill it with troops from England. Or, worse for them, Prussian troops who were mercenaries, hired mercenaries who were worse in behavior by a long shot than the Brits. And things kept smoldering. This was not a good environment for peace and love to develop, and it didn't. Colonists started to stockpile arms and powder for what they could see coming. We go forward to April of 1775, when, again, we know this story. The British sent out 700 troops from Boston. Governor Gage sent them from Boston to seize the illegally stored arms in Lexington and Concord. Paul Revere and William Dawes set out on horseback to warn these towns. I think Revere got arrested pretty quickly, but Dawes made it through. And so Lexington and Concord knew that they were coming. At Lexington, there were a group of armed men there to meet them. No one quite knows what happened, but somebody shot. A shot was fired, and then a lot of shots were fired. And a number of colonists were killed. A few of the British were killed, but the colonists did not stop them. They kept on marching, and they went on to Concord, where they met the Minutemen, who'd had a little bit more time to prepare and a good place to defend. And they decided to defend them and stop them at the bridge across the Concord River, which I went to school a mile from there for 4 years, and I heard this so played over so many times, went and witnessed speeches that I couldn't understand, but heard lots of guns going off that I could understand, and it's just a great deal is made of this in Concord, or has been all the way back. But they kept the British from crossing the river on this wooden bridge. The British retreated to Boston, but were sniped at all the way home, 20-something miles. They'd already walked out, had a 20-mile walk back, and they were being shot at by colonists from behind stone walls and behind trees all the way home. 270 British were killed. Colonists lost 95. And from that point, that was real collision course between the two militarily. The British had started out doing what they felt was a police maneuver to just keep people obeying the law in Lexington and Concord. The colonists had different ideas and saw a different perspective. But rebellion started to spread pretty quickly, and word spread very quickly of all these things happening on without wires and so forth. Less than a month later, on May 10th, 1775, Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain Boys, together with Benedict Arnold, took Fort Ticonderoga by surprise. This is just on the south end of Lake Champlain, now in New York State, and took the fort and held it. On the same day, May 10th, 1775, the Continental Congress began to meet in Philadelphia. Representatives from all 13 colonies met to try and figure out, what in the world are we going to do? We've got something brewing here, and we need to have a united front. We need to know where we stand. Are we all together? What are we doing? Within the next month, there was the Battle of Bunker Hill. All this, the big action in Boston came within the first year or so of Lexington and Concord, where colonists held the hill in Charlestown. The whole battle was seen by from most of the people in Boston, because it was right there for them to observe. The colonists held three different attacks of the British up the hill, and the British finally went home back that night. The colonists were very chuffed to having done that, especially since they'd just run out of ammunition and would not have been able to take another charge up the hill. The British then, to the great delight of Bostonians, decided Boston is not a hospitable place for us to hang out. And they moved the army and their basic operations to New York, where there were many more loyalists and much more support for the British cause at that point. Hoping to find less resistance, the Bostonians were saying, yes, we did it, and yes, we're glad to see them go. Unfortunately, it also meant for them, it also meant a whole other wave of British troops were sent in, not necessarily to Boston, but there was a bigger British force there. Jefferson and others worked on a draft of the Declaration of Independence in early 1776. But then it was signed by representatives from each of the colonies on July 4th, 1776, a little over a year after Lexington and Concord. So a lot of tension, a lot of conflict had happened before this, but most of the war was still to come. Okay, so we think of July 4th, this is not the beginning of things. This is, conflict is well underway, but this is the statement of what we're doing. These are the first two paragraphs written mainly by Jefferson, kicked around between a number of people. But the first paragraph here is just an explanation of what we're doing. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. And he was saying, it's only common decency to the world to tell the world what we're doing and why. So that's what he's saying. And then the second paragraph, he gets right into what we're doing and why. And this is what, to me, is of great interest. He, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. That among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And then he goes on. I don't want to give the whole thing because I'm not going to really talk about that. Two, the majority of it is grievances against George III, a whole long list of grievances against George III. Now, we tend to have grandiose ideas of the importance and blessings of democracy. But democracy itself, as a form of government, is almost without content. And certainly without the content that we so value and attribute to it as democracy. Democracy basically is only saying the majority of people, when they vote, 51% of the people will win the vote, and less than that won't. That's basically what democracy is. A popular vote, the governmental decisions decided on the basis of a popular vote. This system can be used to vote in or vote out anything if you just have the system. Athens, the first example of democracy that we know of, in Athens it was used to condemn Socrates to death for misleading the youth of Athens. And so he was forced to take hemlock and die. In more recent Arab Spring, it's been used to vote in Sharia law, which interestingly means the end of democratic government. So the paradox there that what they used to vote in Sharia law meant so much for democracy, that's all over now. So you see, I mean, democracy as a form of government is without content. It's just a mathematical arrangement, basically. What matters most is the ideas and values and commitments that the people bring to democracy from outside democracy, from beyond or above democracy itself, from beyond the system itself. What do the people, what do the Democrats, in other words, the people acting on it in a democratic way, what do they believe who are building this democracy? What are their values? What do they believe about God? What do they believe about humanity, value, virtue, freedom, happiness, love? All the big things that are important. Law, whatever. What do they believe about them? So Jefferson did not begin the Declaration with an argument for democracy, nor by his long list of grievances about George III, which is where he would soon go. He began with really far-reaching theological assertions. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's amazing. It starts, this is the big deal, and the 4th of July is what it's about. It starts with theology. It starts with laying out the biggest philosophical and theological principles that are being born out here. For example, this little phrase, that all men are created equal, wipes away the notion of the divine right of kings to ruling by inherited authority. In a sort of an unholy mongrelization of Greek and Christian ideas, you have a traditional belief built up on what they call, sometimes called, the great chain of being, with God at the top, angels, and then kings and high people and aristocrats, and then people are less important down the line, and all men are higher than all women, and then to the lower lower riffraff of society. This is not just a hierarchy of authority, although it is that, but it's a hierarchy of being. Is that the king is more fully human and closer to God than the rest. He's higher up the chain of being than the rest. Expressed by someone like Robert Filmer in the 17th century English writer, everyone is born a slave to a natural-born king. And so everybody is a slave to someone who's a natural-born king, because he is simply higher up in this chain of being. And of course it's being, but it also issues it also into authority. Anyone who challenges the king is being sacrilegious. Okay, now, if you can see how this works, the idea of all men created equal, they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that doesn't work with the great chain of being, because it says we're all equal. Jefferson here is leaning hard on the earlier English Protestant thinking, especially that of John Locke in the 17th century, who did not believe there was any such thing as a divine right of kings, or a key term is the inheritance of authority. Is authority inherited, or is authority delegated, or granted, or bestowed? The divine right of kings is no. Authority is inherited. As Jefferson pointed out, if all people are created equal, then authority from God, is still from God, to govern does not rest on someone's head because of who their parents were, but because of the consent of the people that are governed. That all men are created equal is the basis to this whole Declaration of Independence. Without that, nothing would hold together. Legitimacy of their right to revolt, and for the legitimacy of the kind of government that they hope to build, both depend on this. Jefferson knew this, so he put this at the very beginning. Only this statement laid out allows for everything else to make sense as he goes forward. And for this reason, I want to look at this phrase, or at this reality, this claim of the equality of all people, and see where it came from and what it meant. Jefferson wrote in very general language. He knew he was writing for and to both Christians and deists, deists who were children of the Enlightenment. Some deist thinkers were definitely anti-Christian. Jefferson himself was anti-Christian at some stages and in some arguments or remarks. But all were deeply, even the Enlightenment forces who did not see themselves as Christian were deeply dependent on the Christian faith, whether they were aware of it or not. In other words, their ideas did not get generated out of nowhere. They got generated out of whittling down Christian ideas that had been inculcated in the culture for a long time. So to account for Jefferson's line, all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, we have to go back to Christian theology, go back further than Jefferson would have wanted, actually, to Christian theology, because he thought you could demonstrate all these things by reason and experience. You wouldn't need the Bible. We just open our minds and look at the world, and these ethical truths that people had gotten from the Bible will become are clear to us. So here I'll go back to our outline here. We're here at number three, theological foundations. Who is God? Again, I'm going back to how did anyone come up with this? And I hope to show you that it's a pretty amazing thing to come up with, the equality of all people. The Bible starts with God speaking, and from his words, creation comes into existence. This included creation of human beings made in his likeness. God is both infinite, beyond and above everything that we know of and can conceive of, but he's also a person. He's not some principle or an abstraction. He speaks, he acts, he interacts with us. He loves, he makes promises, he gives direction. He sees and hears and knows all that we do. human beings are created by God in his likeness, in his image. We have no list in the Bible explaining exactly what it means to be in the image of God and what it doesn't. But the image of God is who we are rather than something that is in us, to be located at some part of us in our brain or some disposition or some capacity. We are images of God in our being. Einstein famously said that the most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is comprehensible. And by saying this, he was saying two amazing things. One is the world is highly, highly ordered, but also far more amazing is that we as tiny, tiny human beings somehow have the equipment to understand that order and make sense of it, the capacity to comprehend that high level of order. This is a great tribute to both the wonder of creation and how high God has made human beings. But the essence of our God-likeness isn't first in our ability to do physics or even to be rational or moral, because a tiny child that we heard calling out just a minute ago is an image of God, as much of the image of God as any of us. Not all the capacities that she will have, but she is the image of God. Because we are the image of God, we have dignity or worth. This means that we are valued, we are precious to God himself. And that this, if we understand this properly, this is an ennobling reality. Ennobling to each of us as we think of ourselves truly, and also as we think of our neighbor truly. This dignity is an intrinsic dignity or worth. It's not a dignity that is conferred, and this is super important here. It's not conferred by the state or derived from any other human being or social institutions. It's not the result of any achievement of any particular gifts, nor is it a dignity of social status or bearing given by someone, membership in some hall of fame or who's who. It's not acquired by any means, because it's ours by creation. All these other examples would be examples of extrinsic authority, making into somebody's who's who of something or other. By the way, there's about 600 different who's who books. just so that you don't get too excited if you get put in one of them. But all those are extrinsic dignities conferred on us from outside of us. Intrinsic dignity is that we matter because we matter to God. Our dignity and value is increated and sacred in God's sight. For example, it says in Proverbs, this is a theme that's all shot through the scriptures, Proverbs 14:31, those who oppress the poor insult their maker, but those who are kind to the needy honor him. In other words, God makes his cause our cause. We oppress the poor and we're messing with God. Now, if our human dignity is intrinsic, then an extraordinary thing must be true, which has huge political implications, which is that if we have intrinsic human dignity, we are equal in dignity and value with each other. It's not just that we are valued by God, between us and God, but it also means that everybody is on an equal level with respect to each other according to how according to their creation by God. It means that human dignity is universal and important to God underneath all the millions of human inequalities, underneath all the different ways we're unequal and different from one another. This is because people are equal to each other in the very thing that gives us dignity, the valuation of God. Do you see what I'm saying? We're equal in the very thing that's most important of all, is that God values us. God treasures us. To realize how radical this is, we need to just stop and think that means there's no observable human measure that we can use that shows this dignity, that shows this equality. There's no measurable way we can establish on measurable variables this equality. The equality is invisible, but very visible to God. We're different from each other in every measurable scale we can ever conceive of. Intelligence, education, leadership, wealth, prestige, creativity, initiative, height, weight, sense of humor, artistic ability, ability to play the violin, whatever. We're different in any observable variable. The claim is that despite all the measurable differences, we're equal in our intrinsic mattering in the sight of God. Now that seems counterintuitive and certainly counter to experience. How in the world did this idea ever come into existence when it's so counter to experience? That's the thing we need to think about. It's so counter to what we observe around, which is people different from each other. How did it ever get started? Well, on the 4th of July, 1776, equality was not even an ideal of any nation on earth. Equality of all people with each other was not even expressed as an ideal, let alone anything remotely like a practice. Jefferson had the nerve to call it, we hold these truths to be self-evident, which I don't think he really believed. I don't think much of anybody believed they were self-evident. But he was in a bind because he was a deist. He knew perfectly well that it's easy to say they come from the Bible, but he didn't want to express any dependency on the Bible because he was a deist. He believes you could know all the moral principles from the Bible by your reason and your experience. So he didn't want to have to depend on the Bible. That was just like depending on an umbilical cord that we cut long ago and we don't need it. So he called them self-evident, even though I don't think anybody much believed they were actually self-evident. The Stoics had developed some notion of human equality, but it certainly was not Stoicism that was the groundwork of the American Revolution. It was the Bible. It was Genesis 1. Male and female made in God's image, and the extension of that message coming through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and particularly through that and through the expansion of the church, spread more throughout the world than it ever had happened under Judaism. It was those who believed the Bible that really had a basis for this. But it was also those who did not believe the Bible, but who lived in a culture that was so influenced by the Christian faith for generation after generation, after decade after century, who also believed this truth, though they didn't believe that they needed the Bible to tell it to them. So I believe that Jefferson believed that all people were equal, despite his behavior. We'll talk about later. But that's despite all of our behavior who may believe it. This is an incredibly high truth to live up to consistently. Not to excuse him. It's a truth that was held by Christians and deists, and really was the foundation stone of the revolution, a conviction, both the authority to throw off the British and to establish the government that they did establish. But believed by Christians and those who weren't Christians, but who believed it anyway. If we believe in equal dignity, it must be dignity rooted in something which transcends all normal human ranking and systems and hierarchies which we build around each other and ourselves. It must trump their authority. It can only come from God, only come from some transcendent source above human culture. But it was and is believed by many people, like Jefferson himself, who didn't want to believe he needed God's word to tell him about it. That we have a good contemporary reminder of the source of this belief in, say, particularly someone who doesn't believe it at all, probably one of the best known philosophers in the country today, this man Peter Singer, who teaches at Princeton, who blames the Christian faith fully for, he doesn't believe in human equality at all, but he blames the Christian faith fully for the idea of the sanctity of human life. He argues that the sanctity of every human life is absurd, and that it is the fault of the Christian faith which has given it to us. An intelligent dog or pig is more worthy of our care than a severely retarded human child. And if you've read any of his stuff, he's very public, very outspoken, and widely published. His view makes perfectly good sense, at least as a possibility for someone who's a materialist or a naturalist who doesn't believe there's any God there. And so he thinks this idea of the equal dignity and sanctity of all human beings is a ridiculous idea, and it's all the fault of the Christian faith. What are the political implications here? If we really believe in equal dignity, that must be a basic foundation stone of our political system. We must immediately start talking about human duties and rights, even universal human rights. We don't have the rights before God. We don't have rights before God in the sense that we can make demands of God, but we do have rights before one another. We have a right to be treated in certain ways by other people under God, from one to another. It means that the rights of others are a responsibility of all, especially of those in positions of power, to make sure that the rights of individuals are met as they're conceived. The Declaration of Independence, it was at least the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness that are outlined here. These rights have been described in many different ways. You can't take human life without just cause. There must be fair treatment in the court of law. There must allow freedom of conscience for religious choices and commitments and so forth. There'd be many things that would be involved in this. We could think of many applications. But with all the discussion of what we are, of what are and what are not human rights, and you can imagine, you can just listen to the discussions going on today of what are my rights and what are not my rights, all going on all over the world. There's relatively little discussion of where these rights come from. We can think about having the right to a fair trial, the right to not be tortured, the right to choose and live out one's religion of choice. But how do we happen to have these rights? Who could grant these rights? Where are they from? And who says they are rights? Because right implies powerful moral obligation to to grant them. They need some transcendent foundation, And the answer, which many people want, can only be found where they don't want to find it, which is in God, which is in the God of the Bible, who's created us and revealed to us the truth about our equal dignity before Him. But God as a necessary foundation of human rights is unacceptable to the modern secular mind. I ran across someone whose whole field is human rights, and she says, religion should be excluded from the game of even discussing human rights. Religion excluded from the game. Of course, the idea of equal human dignity is true and wonderful, but it's a very high bar to put into practice in reality. We have wonderful statements going all around the world about human rights, but with widespread violations of all of them. It's a truth that makes hypocrites of all nations and all people. You don't need to go far afield to find that hypocrisy. In our own country, what looms immediately is issues of race-based slavery as a gigantic disaster and violation of this truth, and was papered over. As we know, Jefferson himself, who wrote this, owned 300 slaves, or in the course of his life, over 300, I think about 350 slaves over the course of his life, and continued to own them after writing this and after the drafting of the Constitution, which made room for slavery without ever actually mentioning the word. The Constitution contained clanging hypocrisies over slavery, including counting black people as 3/5 of a whole person in order to beef up the population of the southern states that had many slaves in them, including agreeing to in the Constitution to never question the legitimacy of the slave trade until after 1808, and so forth. So it's a very, very shaky history we have on our own, and of course it cost us a civil war and a problem of race that is still with us. But on the other hand, Martin Luther King called this paragraph 2 of the Declaration of Independence a promissory note, an uncashed check to African American people, to which he appealed, calling for the whole country to turn back from its behavior to its ideals, to its principles, from its practice. Women didn't have full legal rights, such as the right to vote, until the 1920s. So it's not just a race-oriented problem, it's a gender-oriented problem. It's hard to tell where we are right now on, let's say, enhanced interrogation. Who knows what that means? It'd be hard to know what it actually means on the ground. We've got all kinds of stuff going on that very probably shouldn't be going on, having anything to do with the principles of the Constitution itself. So the idea of human beings in the image of God creates a very high bar for us to get over. And should be treated, and yet should be central to any political arrangement. Respecting it will always require very, very costly sacrifices politically, economically, personally, which people tend to not want to make. It's fine to treat your friends as equal to yourself, but to treat everybody that you know on this planet as equal to yourself in dignity and value is something that people may want to do, may try to do, even when they try, don't do very well at. This is why this glorious doctrine of humans made in the image of God does not stand alone, cannot stand alone. It has to stand with the truth that human beings made in the image of God, valuable to God, precious to God, are fallen and broken and bent, and they're sinners and rebels before God. So these two sides of human nature that we need to to make sense of the whole picture. We're fallen, made in the image of God, but bent and twisted. The image of God spoiled by the fall. The Bible tells us of rebellion against God by our first parents, no longer wanting to live in gratitude and obedience to Him, but to be independent and make up their own rules. That's what the Bible calls sin. We're stuck with what Immanuel Kant later called the crooked timber of humanity. Somehow that term has stuck. We are crooked timber. The effect of sin is so pervasive that no area of our lives is untouched by it. Sin has an enormous repertoire of arrogance, abuse, self-deception, corruption, violence, selfishness. We can't localize it, reduce it to some island in the South Pacific, or reduce it to one part of our lives, because once we think we have it beaten, it comes in through our back door. I remember Barry Segrin, who used to work here with us, talked about how on the political right and left, people sort of localize where the main sin is. People on the political left tend to think that when you're dealing with economic issues, the main sin to worry about is greed, especially the greed of rich and powerful people. But from the political right, they think also of economic sins, and they say the main problem to be worried about is laziness and sloth. And if the government helps people, they're only teaching them how to be lazy. Barry pointed out that a more biblical view is that both greed and laziness are a problem and come up, and lots more things as well. You can't just say they're all, it's all the sins are on one side of the ledger and not on the other, because both have enormous political and economic consequences, not just one or the other. Sin seems to have a limitless repertoire and can always come in our back door. I always thinking of this private world, public world, of a line about working in Washington, D.C. If you work in the private sector, it's dog-eat-dog. If you work for the government, it's just the other way around. So, there you have it. There's not any freedom from the dog-eat-dog, just in terms of who you're working for. Ben Franklin was concerned very much about how government deals with this brokenness. He wrote, "Democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for lunch." That points gives you a picture of the vulnerability of democracy. A majority vote. But he went on, and he said, "Liberty is a well-armed lamb contesting the vote." So he's saying there both what went into distributing power to different parts of government, but also just the need to protect the minority and need to protect the less powerful, the more vulnerable. If any government is to last and maintain liberty for all, it has to have a way of blocking the crooked timber of humanity from it, corruption, greed, sloth, violence, selfishness, destroying other members of society, and protect the powerless there. Franklin also said, "Liberty is dangerous, but it's the safest thing we have." Again, he's got a good turn of phrase there. In the light of these two things, human high value and human corruption and brokenness, we have a Christian framework of paradox. We are a glorious ruin. That's something we talk about a lot at Libri. Each human being is a glorious ruin. We're glorious, made in the image of God, but we carry the ruin of sin around with us. We're still images of God, but we're bent out of our original shape, to be restored only through the work of Christ, starting now, but completed only in the end time. This is a great human paradox. That means that we are a mixture of glory and shame, rationality and irrationality, love and selfishness, nobility and corruption, sincerity and self-indulgence, heroism and cowardice. We're blessed with a unique dignity by creation, but we're also sunk to a unique depravity by sin. Any other way of relating, or any way of relating to the human being, must account for these two sides. In our friendships with each other, in our churches meeting together, in our local governments, in our families, in every area of our relationship, we've got to, and just looking at ourselves, standing alone, we need these two sides and to be informed about what these two sides mean in our own natures. The Founding Fathers had a pretty good grip on this paradox. There's some great things I could read you by from John Adams. Both Christians and deists. How to let the problem politically, of course, is that how can you construct a governmental structure that lets human freedom fly in all its energy and creativity, but at the same time limits and discourages human tendency to corrupt, destroy, and dominate? And this is, how do you have enough room for people to spread their wings and fly and do wonderful and great things, and yet at the same time limit their destructiveness to one another? Reinhold Niebuhr saying, man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, but man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary. I would say not just democracy, but a certain kind of democracy necessary. Great dangers of not respecting both sides of human nature. I think you could do a whole history of political history and discuss this. Remember, we're talking about ideas that people take to democracy or take to the process of government. If leaders we see and acknowledge only the crookedness of the timber and the ruin, they end up with a cynical view of human nature and will inevitably come up with authoritarian, totalitarian governments because they don't think people have any capacity for creating a harmonious community without being forced to do it. The idea is that people are fools, are stupid, who don't know what's enough with their own good. They're incapable of dealing responsibly with their own freedom. And so all would be ruin. All is ruin and no glory. So they must be dominated. They must be controlled. Thomas Hobbes would be an example of someone with a deeply cynical view of human nature. The choice he gave was between anarchy and tyranny. He said, we've got enough self-interest, so we will choose tyranny, because there's an utter terror of anarchy. Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor parable in the middle of the Brothers Karamazov is a great example of this, one of the most graphic ones that I highly recommend. Takes place in Seville in the Spanish Inquisition in the, I guess in the 17th century. And somehow Jesus himself shows up in Seville in front of the cathedral. There's a little girl's funeral that's happening right there. He raises the girl from the dead out of her own coffin. This is Jesus. In front of the cathedral at her own funeral. Then is immediately arrested by the Grand Inquisitor, taken down to the dungeons and left there for a while. Then the Grand Inquisitor comes and talks to Jesus. He says, you are the problem. You are the one who is cruel. You are the one who's inexcusable. You promised people freedom, a freedom that they can't bear, they can't handle, they can't use it properly. They'll screw it up, they'll destroy themselves and destroy each other. You gave this to them and the world hasn't recovered yet. On the other hand, we know better. We know that we are compassionate. We have our whole thing is out of compassion to people to take their freedom away because they can't use it properly, and we've put on them a compassionate, strict kind of authority. And now you show up here again in the middle of this. Once we've got it almost the job almost completed, here you are here again. This has been often a model of human government as it turns to tyranny. Out of a sense that the only way to govern at all is to govern with an iron fist and propaganda. The hitch is that the leader whose pessimism about human nature, cynicism about human nature, guides him or them into this, needs to take that cynicism and pessimism one more step to realize that it includes himself. And the same brokenness in the population is a brokenness and a self-deception in himself. But the opposite mistake is just as bad, if perhaps not worse, than cynicism. It's a too optimistic of human nature. All is glory and no ruin, especially when it includes the confidence that we have the tools to put human beings right, to tweak and adjust human nature to fit, or human society, human education, human economics, to fit some marvelous new social, political, economic plan that we have up our sleeve. This is the tendency toward utopian ideas, minimizing sin and also minimizing the basic givenness of human nature, thinking that under our controls and our new ideas, people will be transformed and we can make an ideal society of the sort that the world has never known. But there is, in this, a ghastly logic to this trajectory of utopias in modern history. I did a whole study on, listened to a whole study done on utopia and terror in the 20th century. And there's an incredible connection between utopias and terrorism. Not terrorism in the sense of individual bombs, but terror as a policy. If you start with an agenda of thinking you're going to make a perfect society, immediately imperfect people get in your way and mess up your plan, which is frustrating, which is really frustrating if you're very confident in your plan and the importance of you implementing it. So you must remove them, and you have all the moral passion in your system to do it. This is the history of Marxism in the 20th century. It is a horrifying illustration of this. USSR, China, Cambodia, and so on, eliminating tens of millions of their own people in peacetime because they were obstructing the dreams of a classless society. Nazism, the same path, but different dreams and different rules. But both, of course, mocked the idea of the equality of all people, each other, made absolute fun and mockery of it. John Stott tried to outline Christian political commitments and talks about the need for Christians to serve and wait. They must serve hard and long God and neighbor, but also wait, because the final fulfillment of their service is not going to happen in this life. So there must be patience in terms of seeing all the political results that they would hope to come from their efforts. And then Stott points out, the cynic about human nature does not want to serve, and the utopian does not want to wait. And so the Christian must embrace both, and embrace both very hard. The need for virtue. Most discussions about freedom include two kinds of freedom, freedom from and freedom for. Freedom from, negative freedom, is freedom from interference or oppression or of whatever kind. Freedom for, meaning positive freedom, is freedom to pursue excellence, however someone might want to define it. Freedom for, you are not just getting someone off your back, you're having a positive idea of what you're living for, and you're able to pursue it. Some idea of the virtue or even the heroism of a track that you are following. In the Old Testament, the Exodus, the escape from slavery in Egypt, was God freeing them from oppression and slavery and cruelty. But that wasn't the end of it. The Ten Commandments and the whole Mosaic Law was telling them what they were free for and what their freedom was for. And if they obeyed this, they would be able to keep the freedom that God had granted them by getting them out of Egypt and giving them a nation themselves. Let my people go that they may serve me. That's both sides, freedom from and freedom for. The law was given to serve God, so to thrive and to be more able to keep that land that they've been given. This connects directly with thinking of the American founders. Here we hear not just the Declaration of Independence, but as they started to put the government together. Both Burke, of course, wasn't American, but his ideas were very much in circulation. But also Franklin would say things like, only a virtuous people can be free. Only a virtuous people can be free. In other words, if they do not have internal virtue that makes them desire to live in a way that is oriented toward building community and caring for one another, if they don't have those internal desires, internal virtues, we'll need laws from the outside to force them to not be antisocial. So the more free you are to be virtuous from within your own desires, it's in a freedom that is shaped toward community, political freedom will last, and will last without lots of laws. But if there's no internal gyroscope of desire for community, more and more and more and more and more laws will be necessary to keep society civil. And the more external force will be necessary to hold it together. They knew that they needed a virtuous people to keep liberty, to maintain virtue from one generation to another. They saw that they needed to be a religious people. John Adams' famous statement, "Avarice, ambition, revenge, or gallantry would break the strongest cords of our Constitution as a whale goes through a net. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate for the government of any other." And see, he's saying, it's not that our Constitution is some sort of magic. It's only worth anything for people who are really motivated to serve and honor God. The other side of this is, makes you think of some of the discussion after the Wall Street debacle in 2008, people saying, why aren't there more regulations put on the Wall Street banking investment? And the response came back, these people are so clever and so creative in maneuvering around laws and regulations that they would have ways around them before those laws were ever passed. Now, I don't know if that's possibly very cynical, but possibly perfectly right. But that's the uselessness of law in itself if people don't want to obey it. If people just want to avoid it and get around it, they will often, depending on how clever they are, figure out a way to get around it, and the law is impotent. T.S. Eliot wrote in Choruses from the Rock, this is in 1934, of the attempt of secular culture to be independent of God, independent of the church, and independent of the need for virtue. He reflected on the same kind of shape that Adams was talking about. He says, they constantly try to escape from the darkness within, outside and within, by dreaming of systems so perfect that no one will need to be good. But the man that is will shadow the man that pretends to be. I think that's very powerfully worded. Dreaming of systems so perfect that no one will need to be good. If we get the political system right, we won't need to be good. If we just get the economic system right, get the educational system right, then we'll need to be good. Well, not really. This is, of course, the importance of religion in general and the Christian faith in particular, in the sense of positive freedom to be good with the power of the imagination engaged. This is where following Christ is something much more than having a bunch of laws to follow. This is where there's something much more than that, or even what's in the Declaration or in the Constitution. It's something that shapes a whole culture and can give people a desire to do what is honorable, what is good, what is for the common good, and to do that and to pursue it. But this faith can never be coerced, never can be demanded by law. If it is, it isn't real faith anymore. It's not a list of enforceable rules, but nor is it a list of proposed legislation. It must be the freedom of a relationship with God, which ties together all of life into some deeply attractive and life-giving way of living. Oz Guinness speaks of a triangle of how freedom needs virtue for the reasons we've just described. To be free, you need virtue to be free. On the other hand, virtue needs faith, because virtue doesn't come from nowhere. Virtue is the product of faith, well lived. But faith needs freedom. In other words, faith does not flourish under a system of political force and political demands and restrictions on it. And then, of course, that freedom needs virtue. Virtue needs faith. Faith needs freedom. And he sees this as just a circle, a triangular circle of interdependence of realities for us. I'll just end with looking then, as I said in the beginning, I would say something about the future, not just the past history of the Declaration, but its future. Democracy at home here. I think most Christians in Christian history have lived under monarchies, tyrannies that were more and less benevolent, authoritarian rulers. Historically, during time, Christian history has gone on with no democracies to be found. Democracy was seen as an irresponsible form of government. Just look at Athens and see what happened. So people thought democracy was not something we could worth experimenting with. Democracy, though, is not a natural human state or a state of nature. I've argued that it makes sense only in societies where it's profoundly influenced by other ideas that support the reality of us as having real value. It seems that some form of democracy better reflects God's truth than other forms of government that we've seen through history, but only if the right ideas and commitments are brought to it. Because, as I said, democracy itself has no moral content at all. I have certain sympathy with Churchill's line that democracy was the worst form of government except for all the others. And so he's not coming at it from some utopianism there. I've tried to describe how some of the most basic foundations of modern democracy are grounded in God, the God of the Bible. If that's so, what happens when that God is subtracted, when that God is taken away, when belief or faith in that God is no longer vibrant and powerful in the society? This is the question, this is the big question for us today. I think that I can't, I'm not about to be a prophet. Many people, of course, would say, you take God away, nothing will happen, because belief in God never really made much difference in the first place. Belief in God is now marginalized, but God was never really important in the first place. I don't agree with that, but the idea of what happens to democracy that was built, I would say, on deep Christian assumptions, when this confidence in this God and the God of deism, by the way, are no longer really major players. Francis Schaeffer used to be very concerned for this, and he saw us sort of sitting on a tree limb, or better image maybe, we're sitting in a tree house and just sawing off the occasional branch. And you know, the way tree house is supported by several branches and not just one. And so you're just sawing off branches, and eventually you're going to saw off branches that will knock the whole house down. At the start of the lecture, I promised to mention the future significance of the Declaration. Again, I'm not making predictions, but I think our place is quite vulnerable. I think particularly if a man called Jack Miles, professor of English at the University of California and the general editor of a new Norden anthology of world religions, in a somewhat playful tone, he asked, does anyone really believe that all men and women are created equal? But recognizing the delusional premise of American democracy needn't undermine faith in it. Okay? See what he's saying? Does anyone really believe that all men and women are equal? No. Oh, come on. Nobody believes this anymore. But recognizing that it's a delusion doesn't need to undermine our faith in American democracy. He's saying that all men and women created equal is a delusional premise of American democracy. He has a perfect right to that belief. He's not at all sure there's any God there. And if there is no God, he's right. If there's no God there, he's right. It was a delusional premise. But his extraordinary faith is that he believes that it's a delusion, that even though he believes it's a delusion, but that realization won't make any difference to faith in American democracy. won't make any difference the way people treat each other. I wonder if this isn't an utterly naive kind of faith. The British philosopher Stephen Hopgood would disagree very much. He said, the ground of human rights is crumbling beneath us. And he puts this directly to the collapse of viable Christian faith in the discussions of human rights. It's been assumed that it's been assumed that there's a secular consensus about what constitutes human rights, which now we realize there is no secular consensus at all about what human rights are. There's nothing we can appeal to. This is sort of objective. It's not just Christian or based on revelation, but it's based on a majority vote of the whole human race. Forget it. There's nothing that we can bank on that is shared by everybody. To believe in the equal dignity of all people and to take that seriously at every level of life is extremely costly. As I said, it's a very high bar. Nobody, no individual, no nation really approaches really living it out fully. Even those who try very hard. It's not a little game that is fun to play. It will shape every area of our life. Why tolerate anyone or pay attention to anyone who's as disruptive a person as Martin Luther King was if it's a delusion, if human equality is a delusion? Why tolerate someone who's forcing that or pushing those ideas if it really is a delusion? I want to say, of course, that it's not a delusion at all. It's true. I can and do believe in intrinsic dignity of all people. But only because I believe there's a God there, a personal God there, who made us in His image, and with equal dignity and worth. And I think of Jesus' teaching about the least of these, and the last will be first, and first will be last, is getting it right down, cutting through the way we value each other very unequally, and saying the least are going to be very, very important to God. You already see weakening of equal dignity and rights when it comes to the unborn and it comes to the end of life. It will surely be under fire wherever the price of respecting human life gets too high, because respecting the equality of all people is going to cost us. And if that cost gets too high, then it will cave as people don't have the faith to believe it. It's proved very hard to live out by people who do believe it's true. How will it stand up when it's widely believed to be a delusion? So we have to look. We've looked at the start of Jefferson's explanation for the Revolution on July 4th, 1776, that all men are created equal. The phrase is a foundational assumption of all that follows, of what they planned and what they carried out very imperfectly. I think it's no less foundational for the shape of American democracy today and into the future. We should give thanks for the many people who've gone before us and lived faithfully for this truth, and to God for His patience in dealing with us this particular stack of crooked timber of humanity that has been America. We live in a post-Christendom world, which is probably a good thing, but we don't live in a post-Christian world, you know, because it's a world where the power of the gospel is still very much alive. The Church of Christ is very much alive. We've been reflecting on equal dignity of all people in God's image in our political thinking and our acting. We should sharpen ourselves in this to see where issues that come are brought to our attention, but also we should sharpen the way we live. Pay attention to the way the prophets and Jesus Himself evaluated the political health of a nation or of a people, which was, how are the poor and disenfranchised cared for? The widow, the orphan, the fatherless, the least of these brothers and sisters. That is how the prophets measured the serious health of faith in the world. That should be an inspiration to us as well. I'm going to stop there and over to you all. Cover a lot of ground, but any thoughts, additions? This is something that none of us have thought about, so there may be lots of additions.
There's a lot that could be said.
That's right.
Oh, I was going to say, like, I appreciate what you said about the death of Christendom potentially being a good thing for the church. I would like to hear kind of, because I think historically other churches have gotten involved in these issues by trying to gain power politically, which I think has done, like, varying degrees of damage to our standing within society, depending on how it's done down. I'd maybe like to hear some of your perspective on how, what you see as a Christian's job to live this out in that kind of a more of a clear, pluralistic
yeah.
society, just because I think we're past the point of thinking that it's a good idea to do it the same way that we try to do it the best.
I think of just the difference between Europe and the United States. One of the differences being, and our European liberty workers, I have arguments with them about this, but one is in Europe, they have a state church almost across, and also the different angles and so on. And I don't think that's been in their favor. I don't think that's been a help. It opens the door to all sorts of forms of corruption and confusion about the use of political power, of political coercion to force faith or to force obedience to faith or something like this. I think it's really harmful. The First Amendment, I think, is a great step. The federal government will establish no religion. And I think that's been one reason of the vibrancy and power of American Protestantism, for example, that it has never been a state church or a federal church. So I think the confusion of church power and political power is a bad thing to get into. That's why even with George Bush having his, getting Christians doing social work involved with government financing to help them, faith-based initiatives. I never believed that was a good idea. It sort of crashed and burned over a lot of disputes over the First Amendment. But I was suspicious of that and just as happy that it crashed and burned. That means, though, that we must be politically involved and engaged ourselves, aware, and a great danger, I think, today is that Christians will be sucked into packages, left or right packages, rather than looking at each issue separately. I find I just don't fit into any package. I badly don't want to fit. I don't want to fit in the package. And yet, the danger of that is that can limit your. If you were a politician, you would sink your ship. Because you have to be joining one party and be backed by the party, or it could anyway. Not that all politicians are forced into that. But a huge issue is to think through each issue separately, try and exert some sort of leverage and encourage. Run for office. Encourage people running for office. Get in and try and make a difference. I think there ought to be more Christian activism doing this. We're living in I was in college in the 1960s, and so I'm amazed at how apolitical the university is now, even though there's all sorts of controversial stuff going on, and has been, like the Iraq War, going into Iraq, but that didn't create a huge ruckus at universities. I was amazed. I said, what's going on out there? And so the younger generation is much more apolitical, I think. But I think we just need to take seriously political responsibility and try and help each other think about it. There's a lot of Christians in public life, a lot more than were so 30, 40 years ago. There are a lot of issues that really need help. So I don't have a political program.
Yeah.
But yeah. Well, when you throw one up, let me know.
Yeah. No, but I appreciate that. I think that the argument for our nation's I'm happy that I think the conversation's starting to go away from what we just need to bring carry back to public school. We need to put the Ten Commandments up and like stuff that I think has been argued in the past as being the church's response to what we see as the sins of the nation. And I think it comes more from how do we as individuals and also as church communities live out Christ's teaching in our own communities. I think Christianity doesn't always do very well when it's I don't think it's supposed to be a power wielding spot, you know. Like, I don't think the church does well when it's in a position of power governmentally, but I think that it does very well at being an example to a society of this is the way that we're supposed to live.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're the ones that are honoring people more than the people, if we're the ones that are taking care of people, regardless of what they believe or what they would even say that their worth is, so I think that's our duty beyond anything like that.
Yeah, I think there's some lines to draw. I can get in trouble drawing them, but I want to distinguish between ethics of creation, coming from creation, and ethics of redemption. Ethics of creation, or it's what you see just before the fall. Marriage, work, which means the economy, care for the garden, which means environment, and so on. Truth-telling, all these are going on before the fall.
Human life
itself being value. After the fall, the race is divided between the redeemed and unredeemed. I think we need to be careful to, as we are politically involved, say that the realm that we're meant to be dealing with is the ethics of creation rather than the ethics of redemption. So I think we have no business forcing our prayer on public schools. And I think it's a totally counterproductive, but also I don't think that's where we need to be pushing. For example, in the early days in Massachusetts, they were going to do it right, unlike what happened in England. And so everyone who got to vote in town meeting had to be a member in good standing of the Congregational Church. Okay? It has all the best motivations to have a really just and righteous local government. But what does that mean? It means you're not permitting pluralism. You're not permitting people to not believe and still have a role in their own government. So it's a theocratic, it's a requirement to be part of the local government. You need to be a Christian. Now, it was, in fact, a disaster for Massachusetts colony because people weren't about ready to cross the ocean and not vote. So you got people inventing testimonies who weren't Christians at all, but to be able to vote in the town meeting. And you've got, I think, a disintegration of the church in Massachusetts more quickly than it would have happened otherwise, as well as a lot of resentment against the church that to me is unnecessary. Now, that's a lot to ask of them. I mean, given what they've been through, I can totally understand it, so I don't want to be heavy on them because what they've been through was being on the end of a whole lot of persecution themselves. But when the church uses its power, or the state's power, to advance its cause. Like, for example, right into the 19th century, you have to be a member of the Church of England to go to Oxford or Cambridge. You know, what does that do for the Church of England? I mean, that makes a lot of people resent it, I would have thought. And it really was, the church is part of being very unfair to a lot of people in the UK. So that's making confession of Christ a necessary thing to function politically, which I think is totally wrong and a catastrophe to do that. It's hard enough to know whether, and all the forces working on every one of us, to know whether we want to believe in Christ or not without having political coercion lowered on us as part of that. So I want to say we need to have, there's a realm of areas that we need to say this is fair game for political activity. A way you could describe it is, what are the sins that you would want to be criminalized? Okay, that forces us to think very carefully, because there are all sorts of things that are sins that you would not want to be against the law. Pride, maybe. I mean, where do we go with that one? Yeah, where do we go with that one? So I think we have to be very careful what we want to be criminalized. We want some things to be criminalized for sure, but the idea is why. And I think I would say it's drawn a line on the ethics of creation rather than ethics of redemption, like church membership, baptism, confession of Christ, and so forth. Yeah, Richard.
Along that line, you could say that the problem has existed ever since Constantine. It is not an English or American problem. It started out
absolutely
way back.
Right.
I recently read this book about Roger Williams, which came out called The Development of the American Soul.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read that?
I have not. I'd like to, though. He's an interesting guy.
An interesting window into a lot of history about church-state relationships. The author asserts, which I hadn't thought about this before, but he asserts that really there was no country and no place on earth where religious freedom was taken for granted in the 17th century. That every country had its state religion, and in every country you had better either kowtow or be aware of the consequences. And so in that regard, England was no different from any place else on earth.
And by that time, a good deal better.
One could argue that it was, but you had the terrible whipsawing of the spiritual climate of England when you get a Protestant queen who says, okay, we're all Protestants now, we're going to do this, and then that queen's replaced by a Catholic king who says, no, we're all Catholic now, we're going to do this.
And they'll kill each other.
Yeah, and you have actual bloodshed, there was no serious debate about the divine right of kings, really. They figured, okay, kings got the power to do this, or at least a lot of people did.
Mm-hmm.
And so, out of that conflict, terrible crises of conscience for millions of people, out of that was born the Puritans, who were the people that came to Salem, Massachusetts, and caused all that trouble we were just talking about. And so, what they did maybe over in Salem...
And they threw out Roger Williams.
They threw him out, yes. They threw him out in the middle of winter, and he had to march 30 miles through a snowstorm in order to find where the Indians would take him in just so he wouldn't die. Yeah. So he had some experience with persecution. But, of course, all of these things have a history behind them. None of them occur in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And really... the whole concept of tolerating different beliefs was something that Roger Williams pioneered in Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, there's tension between Massachusetts and Rhode Island. And I think it goes back to there, that Rhode Island was where those miscreants and crazy people hung out that didn't go along with what we believe here. And yet, the idea took hold such that Thomas Jefferson could have his unorthodox beliefs and yet not expect to be troubled by it.
Mm-hmm. I think the Anabaptists start this out in the early days of the Reformation, even before Roger Williams came along. Partly, people say, because they were fighting for their own survival, but some early writings by the Anabaptists are some of those helpful things very early on. I don't know whether Roger Williams got a hold of any of that or not. Do you know?
It was from a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, the Anabaptists were not trying to set up a new civilization.
Yeah.
They weren't moving into unoccupied territory and making a new one,
yeah.
which Roger Williams basically was trying to do, which the Puritans were trying to do.
Yeah.
Let's start over here. We want to be a city on a hill. Show the rest of the world how to do it.
That's right.
There's some darkness to that, too, at a certain point. So
that's the what?
My question, though, do you think that the colonists were justified to revolt?
That's a really good question.
And how do you think that affects our view of the 4th of July and also, like, the church's role within the state, I guess? Because I have a hard time. Like, I'm incredibly glad that I'm here, but at the same time, I feel like there's a lot more countries that were way more justified in their revolutions than we might have been.
And are today.
Yeah.
That was people suffering much worse deprivations and denials of freedom in most countries today, more than, well, I don't know, it's hard to tell.
I mean, we always weren't there.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, what really got, I mean, the whole thing really got up and running in Boston. and a huge thing was turning the tap off on their economy. And just the with all the expectations, and they were filled with all the good thoughts about Parliament and freedom and so on coming from England itself. I mean, it's the thinking of Locke that fueled much of it, so they were turning back to the English the thinking of that had been going on in England itself. And there's all sorts of ways that question could go. I mean, one issue is what does Romans 13 really teach about the authority of the head of state? There's a way you can read that to say that the authority, just by being in authority, has the right under God, or has the support of God to be there, irrespective of what he does in any way. Even though it says the purpose of the leader is to reward righteousness and discourage unrighteousness and so on. But there's a way you can read that allows no wiggle room, that if a leader is there, that's what you've got to follow. Now, that was Nero when Paul wrote that, but Nero wasn't as bad as he later became. He was probably no angel, but he wasn't the sort of sociopath that he seemed to become later on. Most of the Christians that I've known who've... well, first of all, you need to distinguish between civil disobedience and revolution.
Yeah.
Someone like Martin Luther King was not into revolution. He was into civil disobedience to call us back to the initial principles. So he wasn't a rebellion against the original principles at all. And non-violently, of course. The question is taking up arms against your own country. Most of those who I've had some respect for who've argued for this is that you can do this only if you have another government in the wings waiting to step in, or even a palace revolution, so that you have, because the great evil, I think, and I think this is fair, that Paul is warning against is of anarchy, of a lack of leadership at all altogether, and that is unbelievably costly and chaotic and destructive, and gives the devil full throttle. So Bonhoeffer, for example, took part in the plot against Hitler's life, which wasn't a full-scale revolution, but was the equivalent of that, because he judged that Hitler was so central to the whole thing. But they had a whole, that was part of a of a sort of an aristocratic arrangement of generals and politicians and so on, who, if this plot had succeeded, they would have stepped right in with a whole governmental structure. But just feeling that this is, we cannot allow this to go on, this is such an absolute parody of turning God's values upside down, and destroying Europe in the process, and much of the world. I have sort of difficulty seeing the plight of the colonists as being as serious as what Bonhoeffer faced. On the other hand, what they were doing was not pretending that what they were enduring was so appalling in terms of suffering, but it really was a revolution of ideas. It really was on principle that there's nothing to stand between where we are now. Given what the king is doing, there's no stopping him to have total tyranny of the sort that would be a negation of everything that Britain has stood for and that they've stood for. So it wasn't as if they were enduring such a high level of suffering or annihilation or something like this. But I have trouble, frankly, seeing getting that past Romans 13. I haven't read of what they've written about it, because I'm sure some did. A lot of them, like Sam Adams, felt that the revolution would enormously benefit the church. I don't know what we do with that as a motivation. But yes.
You've given me a lot to think about, and I've been trying to process your comments. I'm trying to listen.
Sorry,
to your inquiries and trying to figure out where they're coming from. As one who used to bicycle in my early teens from North Cambridge to Lexington. I'm guessing you and I are about the same age, because we were both in college around in the 60s.
Yeah.
You filled in some of the pieces of the puzzle for me. And then as one who has taught American history for quite a while, I have struggled with the disconnect between theory and practice. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, having been at the Boston Common, listening to and participating in the reading of Frederick Douglass' 1852 speech, what does the slave have to do with the 4th of July?
Yeah.
And I struggled with the discrepancy between the theory all people are created equal and the females in this room, mm-hmm, who are still languishing and not sharing the benefits of the social contract fully. Mm-hmm. And during my early years as an educator, I was a consummate optimist. The glass was always half full. And
optimist in terms of what? Optimist in terms of what?
In terms of the capacity to fulfill the social contract. We're going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
As I approach my sunset years, it's becoming increasingly difficult for me to see the glass as half full.
Mm-hmm.
And you reference the bar is very high.
Mm-hmm.
I see precious little evidence of the capacity of political and religious leaders, mm-hmm, to deliver more on the social on this experiment, on this contract.
Mm-hmm.
And as an experiment, I'm beginning to wonder about the viability of the concept.
having attended a Christian college mm-hmm. in the 60s, encountering injustice mm-hmm. that's unspeakable, mm-hmm. having just gotten out of the service, I mean, that really mm-hmm. created a problem for me, mm-hmm. having served the country mm-hmm. and then come into conflict with policies that were in conflict, in my view, with the contract.
Sure.
And yeah. with my own life experience. Yeah. Here I am trying to be hopeful and optimistic for young people, but I really don't have a lot to... I don't have a whole lot to hold up for them to say, this is what we can do. And I have... Certainly in the last 2 or 3 years with all the issues that have been going on with Black Lives Matter, I want to be able to present to those who are coming after me and you a sense of hopefulness. Mm-hmm. And that's becoming increasingly And so I ask the question, who's responsible to move the needle on the dial closer to a better place? Who's responsible for that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, everybody's responsible at some level, but there's obviously places where... where it's very, very focused. I'm silenced in part. That's why you can't hear me. Everybody has certain responsibility. There's a responsibility not to go around. But obviously there are particular places where there are bottlenecks, there are things stopping growth. I'm not sure I can answer that as to where what we've, particularly at a societal level, I think one can do something individually, but to at a policy level or to say this is where something needs to happen, I'm torn between liberal and conservative in a way. The left seems to say the problems are economic, we need to straighten them out. The right, with some plausibility, says we're suffering from a crisis in family disintegration, that the disadvantaged were catastrophically affected by liberal divorce laws, easy divorce in the 60s, and the disintegration, the lowering of the authority of marriage and family, and ironically, the progressive, well-educated, and well-financed are now the most married. The people who are pushing for feminism, who are pushing for liberal divorce laws and so on in the 60s and 70s, and for loosening the bonds of marriage, are now the most married and stay in their marriages longest. And I hear some conservatives saying, which I think there must be something to this, that those who are more vulnerable in society could not handle that teaching of that loss of the authority of marriage. And so I think a huge problem is family and the strength of family. It's obviously economic, too. How to move on that is beyond me, because it's such a cultural reality. There are more, in one way, there are more safety nets now for people on the bottom end of the economy than there were 25 or 30 years ago. But there isn't the respect for family, the place for family, and I think that has been very costly. What we do about that, I think, I mean, the church certainly can, is it a place to do something, but it's how fast, how's it going to happen? We go to an African-American church ourselves, have for the last 20 years. I'm not sure how much we have been able to contribute by doing that. I hope a little bit, but I can't sort of point to achievements or something along the way. I don't know. And yet I want to say I certainly don't want to give up.
We must be related.
Maybe.
It sounds like you grew up in Concord.
Near Concord.
Near where?
Pepperell.
Okay, that's close enough. For,
I think it's a longer bicycle ride, though, from Cambridge.
Well, it's a longer bicycle ride. At any rate, this is the second time I've been in this room in 2 or 3 months.
Uh-huh.
The first time I was here, Think Pen was holding forth on education. And as an educator, I could relate to a lot of what he was offering. And I'm going to respectfully suggest, having been in the business for half a century now, that schools play a major role in how students, young people, understand a history. And I thank you for getting us, you know, there were antecedents to this document, which most children know nothing about.
Yeah.
I didn't get them. I was going to say that. You educated me a lot.
And there are a lot of other pieces of history that you and I are familiar with that add value to the understanding of people who are speaking or searching. It's not presented in schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And because I think I have a bias, I look to an institution, certainly the church plays a role, but every day people in this room either have been or are going to a place called school. And I can be hopeful when I see things happening in school that enlighten and provide provide hope for younger people. And that's the good news. The bad news, I can't find many schools that are doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find many teachers that are doing that.
Yeah. And what do you, at what level and what do you?
I've done it all from elementary school principal to graduate school professor. I've done it all.
Mm-hmm.
And the message is the same. As an educator, I am obligated, and when I have an audience of graduate students, as educators, you are obligated to enlighten.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to just stick to the manuscript.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you make of? Because to me, I see one of the key things is very, very early education, or very early. I mean, someone like Jeffrey Canaday in New York. Do you have much of a view of what he's doing and what he's trying to do? Are you familiar with his?
A little bit. People who are not aware of the work that he's doing are not beneficiaries of that approach.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
Yeah. But he's, those who have not heard of him, he's working in about a square mile of Harlem or something like that. And he's particularly, he for some reason lived in a place, a fairly white community, he's a black guy, and who was amazed at how much the people with young children spent a tremendous amount of time in the very early months with their very young child, and talking, doing all sorts of different things, rather than just leaving the child in front of it, whatever it is. He's tried very hard to get going on early child. It's even almost too early to call it education, but interaction with very, very young kids in the first year and a half of life, when brain development really happens in a way that doesn't happen later on if it's not happening. We had a student here who's worked there with him, and it's not heaven on earth, which isn't a surprise. But it seems to me what he's trying to do is something that's a real pressure point. That's missing, and I wish was more widely known and more worked on, because if minority kids are starting out with a certain deficit as a result of basically neglect in the first 2 years of life, then you know, after that time, always all sorts of things can happen. People can get caught up, but it's really a lot is lost.
Your point is well taken. I'll just make this observation and give someone else a hard time. I can be hopeful when young people ask questions. How old are you now? You're still young enough to ask questions. Good job.
Right, I must be too old then.
My world view, and thank you for the observation about family. Having taught in the town of Harvard for 4 years, that's where I started my career 50
uh-huh.
years ago.
Uh-huh.
My world view at that time was shaped by a principle, my principle. I had a young woman in class, in one of my classes, who was in the B group. People were categorized. A group and the B group. A group are the whiz kids, the B group are the other kids. And this young girl was struggling. And I asked my principal if I could do a home visit. I knew this stuff was coming from someplace. And I'm a rookie, so what do I know? I'm going to do a home visit. And my principal stroked his chin and said, "Work with the kid." And so, I didn't know anything. I worked with the kid.
But don't find out what's going on in the family.
I had nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going to fix the parents. The parents were broken. I'm not going to fix them.
Yeah.
So, that event, help me understand, I don't give a rat's rump what happens at home to kids. I'm a main event in their life when they're with me.
Mm-hmm.
Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
The teachers that I've had in my class in graduate school that had that worldview, their students were in a very different place. I'm going to use you as an example, because I just met Richard. Richard's worldview is he can't do it because of the parents.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? His kids don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the next teacher said, "My kids are going to do it because I'm going to be the surrogate parent."
Mm-hmm.
And that's a worldview. That's an approach.
Yep.
So that gives me hope.
Yeah.
When I see teachers doing the stuff that parents should do, but aren't doing.
Yeah, yeah. And how impossibly can that happen with big classes and the number of people you've got to deal with? And wow,
well,
that's just in a very limited way.
You'd have to know more about some of my students to make it happen. You'd have to know more about me. That's what I do. That's my life's mission. Is to make it happen for the kids in the B group. And adults, when I work with adults, ex-cons, drug addicts, unemployed men and women, they get the same treatment and they end up in a better place because of the person standing in front of them, as opposed to, geez, I can't do anything with these people. They're too badly damaged. And that's biblical. Christ didn't come to fix those who were whole, far as I know. He came to fix those who were broken.
That's right.
So I bring that to the game.
And I'm sure progress that is made is going to be made. Well, maybe there will be structural or decisions made at economic levels, high education world, or whatever. But I think the most important things will happen with one on one.
Thank you for mentioning the 60s and the war. It was young people that led the revolution in the 60s, college students. For what it's worth.
Certainly was. Okay, any other things we'd like to run with? Yes, Richard.
Well, just since you had the title of what happened on the 4th of July, we could note what happened 50 years to that day afterwards.
Okay, I don't know when that...
July 4th, 1826, was the day on which both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
John Adams' last words as he lay there dying was, "Thomas Jefferson still lives."
And they got together after battling most of their lives.
They had some sort
of rapprochement, didn't they?
They had, had a very varied relationship.
We
have the word calumny from that. When Thomas Jefferson hired Mr. Callum to print newspapers full of lies about John Adams, that was where the word calumny came from.
No kidding.
Jefferson paid a propagandist named Callum
to write awful things about John Adams.
Bad things about Jefferson. About Adams. When Adams was president.
Wow.
Of course, some of the things Adams wanted to do were not so great either, but they were.
and he won't be the last one to have tried to do stuff like that.
So at the end of the day, what I'm hearing is we have this treasure in earthen vessels, but on vessels of Christ.
They are.
That's for sure. I think it got me. I didn't dare get into this tonight because I was already too long. But I think it amazed me just in this study is how much the early folks in Boston and maybe the revolutionaries across the board used the term slavery in terms to describe themselves and saw their suffering and their... Meanwhile, many of them owning flipping slaves, for kind of luck. I mean, you want to, what is happening? And it just seems such a reach and such a... you know, I could totally relate to Frederick Douglass and seeing that the 4th of July is a celebration of hypocrisy. You know, the whole blasted thing. You know, what in the world do people think they're doing? So someone gave his speech, did they? Or his essay?
Every year on the Boston Common it's read.
I see.
And other places throughout the state. And I'm guessing around the country.
If people
haven't read it, just go online. Frederick Douglass, oration at Corinthian Hall, 1852. It will read his speech. It will blow your mind.
It's a zinger. It's a real zinger. because he was a person of incredible grasp and just ability to articulate amazingly well. Excuse me?
One of the things that I was thinking, I feel it's kind of simplistic, but I've taken a lot of comfort over the years with just the truth that Jesus came when Israel was under, or Jews, right, under a Roman occupation,
right,
and that he chose really ragamuffin people to uneducated people to join with him, and that he trained those people and that they changed the world and were a result of that. And I think for me, when I read this, I was just in Washington before I came up here, and on the day the Supreme Court actually made their notice decision, it was remarkable. I mean, I was there for a friend's wedding, and we ended up taking a trolley around town, and I hadn't thought that I was even going to get out to see the city a little bit. It's been a long time since I've been to the monument, but we pulled up in front of the trolley out in front of the Supreme Court building, and I was like, earlier today, okay, and, you know, and the Capitol over there, and then we wound back around, and we actually started at the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, and that was remarkable to read the etchings on the wall and to see him hold the Declaration, and looking at Jefferson, and I learned about that Lincoln's behind him.
He needs a stern glare.
He has a stern glare, and he's holding the Declaration in his hand, kind of saying, hey, he started this deal. You, buddy, you know, like, we got to get to this point now where we actually live this out. And I don't know, for me, that day, I went to Lincoln Memorial at the end of the day, or the end of the evening, I should say, so, you know, just a couple of hours, but stood on the 32nd stair of that monument where MLK gave his I Have Dreams speech. And I just stood there and I thought, what a weird day to be here. Like, I don't even, you know, but I feel encouraged and, I don't, in the way that, I don't know, like, personal transformation is so key. And I think, like, what you were saying, sir, just about you choosing in and taking responsibility for yourself in the way that you're going to educate your students and the people that come across your path, I just feel like that's what we get to do. And so, for me, I don't know, I feel like it can be really discouraging. You know, I'm kind of, like, closer to 40 now than not, which is kind of exciting and fun in my life season. But I just, I don't know, I feel less of the chaos, I guess, of the changes, and then the concern about, like, what it's all going to become. And I think I know enough where I'm like, these are the things I do believe, you know, and I'm going to walk these things out in my life. And I think I feel like legislation is going to be what it's going to be, and we might not do this well, but if I choose to live this life for him, and, like, my loyalty remains there, not to a government, not to a system, but to the Yahweh, like, yep, him, I think I'm going to be okay, and I think we're going to be okay. So, I don't know. I love this, though. Like, it gives me so much to think about. I just kept coming back to that again and again, though. And I love the part about just democracy. Like, one of the things that Sandra Richter, is that she says, she says, you know, it's like a mob. You know, it's kind of like mob government versus, like, monarchy, where it's like, you know, like, or a theocracy or something like that. And I thought, isn't that kind of the truth? It's sort of like what the mob thinks is important. That's what happens. And not everybody agrees, and that's kind of crazy that we live in this sort of society, but here we are, you know, a few hundred years in, and, like, wonder what it's going to become. But I'm just taking a lot of comfort, I guess, in the fact that I get to live that kind of life today. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because the other stuff kind of brings me into a place of fear or chaos, and I don't think that's going to work.
Yeah. Like, and I think my hope in this and related areas isn't in major systemic drifts or changes, but it's in individuals that I see that I don't think I would have seen 20 or 30 years ago. And got to think that somehow something's going on that makes it worth it, makes real. It's been really interesting in our church because you see some of the young kids coming up, and some of them have a lot going for them, and I dare to hope a lot for them.
What I'm hearing in your presentation, you're presenting with the person walking along the beach, throwing stuff, pushed back into the water.
Oh, sure, yeah.
One at a time.
Yeah.
Right. the rest of the stuff is too big for me.
Yep.
It's above my pay grade. I can make a difference. You can make what I was saying. You can make a difference in that life that you touch, and that's the best. That's the best I can do at the time.
Well, I think if we are Christians trying to honor Christ, we have to say, okay, God, what is my responsibility here?
Yeah.
And look to Him to say, okay, He's given me responsibility for X and Y, but not for Z. So I'll let Z alone, work on X and Y. Work on the things that He's placed in your hand. Like when God called Moses, He said, Moses, why don't you do this? And look in your hand, you've got a staff, you've got a rod. Use those, the tools that you're familiar with.
Use
what you got, and we're going to do some things together.
Yeah. Well, I also think that, like, God was honestly afraid, like, of things that are going on in the government. Like, I don't think that we as Christians need to be afraid. That, like, if we really believe that God's sovereign, and we know what we're called to individually, that there's a need to fear in the way, or to react in